This is Andrew Barber Starkey welcoming you to the Mastermind Interview Series, where every month we give you direct access to the wisdom of the most important authors, speakers, and trainers of our time. My guest today is someone I've been wanting to interview for a long, long time. I first read her book, Overcoming Under-Earning, over 2 years ago, and immediately realized that she had identified the secret as to why so many people struggle financially. This is a huge issue for my target audience of self-employed entrepreneurs and small business owners, and I know you're going to get a tremendous amount from this interview. Barbara Stanley is a woman on a mission, and her mission is to motivate women to become financially empowered. Although she focuses on working with women, the principles she teaches are equally valuable to us men. Barbara has a background in business and is a journalist, and she holds a master's degree in psychology. Her extensive research and personal experience with money give her a unique perspective on financial issues. She's been featured on Good Morning America, The View, and many times on CNN, CNBC, and Fox News, as well as in the New York Times and USA Today. Barbara, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm just so looking forward to this. So why don't we start a little bit with your story? I know your father was not just wealthy, he was a little bit famous. Can you kind of tell us how you got from there to here?
I would be happy to. My father was the R of H&R Block. And the only advice he ever gave me about money growing up was don't worry. Because under that was the unspoken assumption that there'll always be enough and I'll always have a man to take care of me. And that was fine because I found money very confusing and intimidating. I just wanted to spend it. And not only did I get married, but I married a financial advisor. But what I found out very early in my marriage is that he was a compulsive gambler. And I found this out very early, and for 15 years, that's how long we were married, I continued to let him manage the money, because that's how terrified and intimidated I was by anything financial. And it wasn't until one day I went to the ATM, and I went to get something like $50, and it said, sorry, no money. And that was a moment I knew that I had a problem. So I got the divorce, but I said, money's not my thing, I don't want to deal with money. Well, I had this theory that if you don't deal with money, your money will deal with you. And I got tax bills for over $1 million for back taxes Max didn't pay, for illegal deals he got us in, and of course my signature was on everything. I did not have $1 million. My ex had left the country. My father wouldn't lend me the money. And that was the moment. That was the moment I really hit bottom. That was the moment I knew I had to get smart. And I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew staying stupid was no longer an option. And I was a journalist at the time, and I was hired for a freelance writing project that it required me to interview women that were smart with money.
Isn't that an interesting opportunity? How the universe delivers.
I really believe that when you make a commitment, a down-to-your-toes commitment, like there's no back door here, the universe revolves to help you reach your goal. And as a result of those interviews, it's like no one had ever explained to me the process, how you go from feeling stupid to actually getting smart about money. So I not only did what these women did and got smart in a very short period of time, but I wrote my first book, Prince Charming Isn't Coming, How Women Get Smart About Money, and became a financial educator. I was traveling all over the country. My book was selling great, but I couldn't make money. I couldn't make money no matter how hard I worked. And you can ask my kids. I had 3 kids. I was never home. I was working all the time. So I said, I wonder if I could do from earning money what I do with managing money. So I went out and I interviewed 154 women who made anywhere from $100,000 to $7 million. And I wrote the book, Secrets of Six-Figure Women. And I want to tell you, I started making 6 figures before I even finished writing the book. And it was so profound for me that in the year 2000, which is when I started to write the book, I started getting Overcoming Under-Earning classes to see if I could teach what I was learning from these women. And a couple of years ago, I went back and interviewed all the people who had been through my workshop. Now, they were all women, but so many of the women had taken the workbook and given it to their husbands or boyfriends. But I also interviewed quite a few men for that book too, Overcoming Under-Earning. And that's what I have been focusing on, making money and managing it wisely. The two go very much hand in hand.
Well, and I think the making money is the place we first want to look at it. One of the things you mentioned in the book that really struck me was you talked about the 150 women that you interviewed that were so successful. But you said something that caught my attention. You said every one of them grappled with fear and self-doubt. So how did they become successful then?
You know, these women were very, very confident women, I have to tell you. And I expected them to be confident. But as we got deeper into the interviews, I saw how every single one struggled with fear, struggled with self-doubt, how 95% felt like a fraud and were afraid others were going to find out. And I thought, well, that's just what I feel like. But the difference between them and me is they didn't let the fear stop them. And that was a huge, huge awareness for me, that in the high-earning game, there is no such thing as fearless. It is all about being afraid and doing it anyway.
Which is what they call courage, right?
That's right. But I said, courage is not the absence of fear. As I wrote in my book, one of them, courage is automatic conformity. The absence of courage is automatic conformity. That means doing what you think you should do, not what you want to do.
Right, and courage is experiencing or feeling the fear and stepping into it anyway and moving ahead.
Right. The number one requirement for overcoming under-earning, the number one requirement, I always say that to people I coach, there's only one requirement for success in my coaching with me, and that is the willingness to be uncomfortable. Because success in anything, I don't care if it's losing weight or managing money, is always just outside your comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So let's talk about what's the definition of an under-earner? You talk about overcoming under-earning, but how do we know whether we're under-earners or not?
That's a really good question. That's really good. And the definition of an under-earner is anyone who earns less than she needs or desires, despite her efforts to do otherwise. anyone who earns less than he needs or desires, despite his efforts to do otherwise. It has nothing to do with the amount you make. You can make six figures and still be an under-earner. And you can make far less and not be. There is what I call a mindful low earner. My daughter, for example, who's just visiting me, is a nursery school teacher. She earns much less than she probably could otherwise, but she earns enough to meet her needs, and it's a conscious choice because she does what feeds her soul. Under-earning is never a conscious choice. It never feeds our soul. It is always a condition of deprivation, and not just of money, but of time, of freedom, of choices, of joy, and most of all, of self-esteem.
Well, you know, it's funny you talk about people can, it's possible to earn a six-figure income and still be an under-earner because the people that are coached by me and people that are members of our program, they all know that even though I do earn a solid six figures, that really the only thing between my program and the program and earning many, many millions of dollars a year is me, because the program definitely has, it's that good. It makes that much difference. And yet, you know, I struggle, you know, like I said, I earn a solid six-figure income, but I definitely am under-earning compared to my potential.
You know, it's very interesting because I started interviewing Women Who Make Millions because that's my next book and that's my next goal, to make millions. And I've been seeing there is a difference. I don't know that we want to talk about this now, but there really is a difference. And going from six figures to seven, there is a difference in thinking. Because really, the biggest difference between an under-earner and a high-earner, and a high-earner and a million-dollar earner, is all mindset. Really, it's how they think, not so much what they do, it's how they think.
Well, of course we want to hear about the difference between a six-figure income and a seven-figure earner. Even, we've got many six-figure earners listening to this, and they want to get there. And even the ones that haven't reached six figures yet, maybe they can leap from where they are to seven figures.
So you want to hear some of it?
Absolutely.
Okay, I know. I hear the excitement in your voice. Okay, so the thing that what you need to go from under-earning to higher-earning is you need a profit motive. You have to want to make money. Money is a good thing. You love money. Now, this sounds really obvious, but so many of us are ambivalent about or dislike money and the people that have it. AARP did a study not too long ago, and they asked 2,300 people, do you want to be rich? And 43% of the women and 20% of the men said no, because they thought money was bad, and the people who had it were greedy and sensitive and felt superior.
And even the people that do, you know, some of the people that did say, yes, they want to be rich, 80% of the men, they also have still their own idea about what rich is and their negative beliefs about people that are, quote, filthy rich and so on.
That is absolutely true. And as long as you have negative beliefs about money or the people that have it, you are absolutely not going to let yourself have it. But once you do shift into the profit mode, once you do get your mind wrapped around that money is a good thing, that the more I make, the more I can do, the more freedom I have, and the more I can give, once you wrap yourself around that, what takes people from six figures to seven, eight, and nine, there's another drive, and you have this. You absolutely have this, Andrew. And that's they're driven by a higher purpose. It's a combination of profit motive plus higher purpose, that they're doing what they're doing for the greater good, to make a difference, for the passion. And that passion is what propels them when things get tough, when things get really tough, as they do.
Well, they do get really, really tough. And, you know, I have seen people a number of times get into the seven-figure realm, including some clients I've worked with. But what I've noticed, if they don't have that higher purpose, it's not sustainable.
It's not sustainable.
I mean, they can get there, but it just takes such a commitment. I mean, even hitting six figures is so incredibly challenging. And maybe six figures is the hardest one of all.
No, it's not. And the only challenge, the biggest challenge, is in shifting your mindset.
Yes.
And see, what I say I do is become containers that can hold the money. Because what most of us are doing is playing a higher earner game, like a sieve, and the money just goes through it. So we want to patch up those holes. And the way you patch up those holes is much more in shifting your mindset. As Albert Einstein said, you cannot solve a problem at the same level of thinking you were at when you created it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really critical. One of the things that differentiate million-dollar earners from six figures is their level of mental discipline and strategic thinking. And those were really critical. And briefly, I'll explain that. Mental discipline means they were rigorous about the words that went into their head and out of their mouth. They were rigorous about the quality of their thoughts. And this wasn't Pollyanna thinking. One woman even said she charged every time one of her employees said, can't. Use the word can't. She charged them a dollar.
Yeah.
It's like every obstacle they saw was an opportunity. It sounds so trite when I say it to you. But yet, it's that disciplined thinking. Not you can't afford the luxury of a negative thought, that kind of thing,
yeah,
as the title said, but also the words that came out of their mouth. Because the words that we speak, sometimes it's harder to control the thoughts that we think, but it's easier to control the words that we speak. They really were rigorous about self-depreciation. They would not let that happen in their life. The strategic thinking meant they kept their eye on their higher purpose and their vision, but they kept a very, very firm eye, the other one, on their bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very attuned to the numbers. And this was hard because many of these people, and entrepreneurs tend to be a creative type, a big vision type, big thinker types. And as many of them said to me, this was a skill I had to learn, and it wasn't easy. But it really is being absolutely vigilant
Well, you know, it's interesting because we'll talk later about your some of your steps to overcoming under earning, and of course, now we're talking about respecting and appreciating money, which is one of them. But before we even get there, what's the role? Like, how do you become an under earner, and what's the role of self esteem and self value in that?
What I noticed that I didn't get this from when I interviewed high earners, but when I went back and interviewed people who had been through my workshop, and those, I interviewed hundreds of people who had been through, and some of them came in under earners and stayed under earners, but I was interested in the others who came in under earners and had remarkable results afterwards.
Isn't that a great thing to do? It's like what we do too. When people get the results, it's just such a win for you and me, right?
It's a win for me, but I wanted to see the distinction.
Yes.
What was it that enabled them? What was it that happened in that workshop for one group that didn't happen for another? And one of the distinctions I made is what I heard every one of the those who achieved remarkable results, they all had at some point, maybe not during the workshop, but afterwards, what I came to call the click. When it just clicked that they deserve to earn more for no other reason than they're worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Then they deserve it. That it's okay that they deserve it. They're just click. And that is absolutely a condition of raising your self-esteem, your love for yourself, your valuing of yourself. You know, it's really interesting. I ask every high earner, and I still do with everyone, are you doing what you're doing for the money? And they would consistently say, 99% of the time, oh, no, I'm not doing what I'm doing for the money. I'm doing it for the passion, for the challenge, for the recognition. But at the same time, now this was really valuable to me to hear, but at the same time, I damn well want to be well compensated.
Because I'm worth it.
Because I'm worth it. And that's, I really thought until I started these interviews, that the reason I couldn't make money was because I'm a writer. And everyone knows writers don't make money. And when I started interviewing these women, in my first dozen interviews, three of them were writers.
Uh-oh.
And I thought, well, there went my excuse. And what I realized, it was valuing yourself enough to ask for more. And as one woman said to me, if you don't value yourself, your client never will.
Right, so our self-employed entrepreneurs and small business owners, I mean, almost always, you know, in this situation, we're selling ourselves rather than somebody else's product or something. And I notice that when I suggest people raise rates, it's the hardest thing they could ever do. So would that then be directly connected to their belief in their value, or are there other fears in there as well?
Well, here's the thing. It is real. This is what I noticed. This is how people say, well, how did you do it? How did you go from, in such a short time, making six figures? Because I'd never made over $50,000 in my life, not even close. And one of the things I saw that successful, as one woman said to me, honey, you don't get what you deserve. You get what you demand. You have to ask for more. And it was scary. It was scary for all these women, but they did it anyway. And that's where the role of courage comes in being afraid and doing it anyway. And I heard many times how they would stand in front of the mirror and practice so they could do it without laughing or apologizing or excusing themselves. But they would ask for outrageous things. And what they taught me is that no just means not now. And they kept asking and asking until they often got it. And even if they didn't get exactly what they were asking for, they got more than they would have.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about how to do that as well. And as a coach, one of the things I've found, and I was in sales for many years, I always found that it was so much more effective to make a decision before I went into a meeting into how I was going to respond to a particular situation, whether it be them asking for a discount or giving my rate or whatever. And this comes back to the strategic part, I guess, of the seven-figure earners as well. But I would have a strategy, and I would practice what I was going to say, and I would resolve at the end of the meeting, I was going to ask for this, and if I didn't give this, here was my backup plan. And I would always do that. And, you know, it comes to that point of it just being this big mountain in front of me. I go, I have to ask. You know, I committed to myself I was going to ask this. And then the words come out of my mouth, and they would look at me, and they wouldn't even blink. I said, oh, yeah, no problem. And it was such a big obstacle for me in my own mind, and yet, you know, for them, it was either yes or no. It really wasn't a big emotional issue for them.
No, but it was for you, and it is for many. And that's why, it's so funny, while I was writing Overcoming Under Earning, I got a call from someone who had read my secrets book. And she was just feeling all over the place. She had just raised her fee. She was an attorney. And she had just raised her fee. And she had just told her a client. And she felt so uncomfortable, and she felt so bad. And he got really upset, but he ended up paying them. You know, he agreed. And she called me, and she said, I just feel so bad. I feel uncomfortable. It's just awkward. I said, that's fine. Good.
Yep, that's it. Yeah,
feel awkward. That's fine. The important thing is she asked, and she got it.
Absolutely.
To me, discomfort, that feeling of awkwardness, the feeling of tension, is not a bad sign. It is an indicator light that you're going in the right direction.
Yes, yes. So when you come up against that fear, then that's telling you where you're on the right path to getting to where you belong to.
That's exactly right. And I put myself in fear's way all the time. All the time. And I just, whenever I get that fear coming up and I get that scared, like a little girl feeling inside me, like, I can't do this. Oh, no, I don't have what it takes. I go, oh, goody. That means I'm going to the next level.
Mm-hmm. Or not.
It feels good. It doesn't mean it feels good.
Right.
But it's a great sign, and I know it.
But what happens to our self-esteem if we back down in the face of that fear?
Well, that's interesting you ask, because when I asked women that I interviewed, what is the number one factor in your success? You know what they told me? It was belief in myself, ahead of education and talent. And the thing is, where they got their belief in themselves was when they went out of their comfort zone, when they do something they thought they couldn't do. And even if they fell flat on their face, but they got back up and kept going. That eventually gave them confidence. Like one woman said to me, she says, I was not born with this confidence gene, but she says, I had been terrified of statistics and that kept me from going to get my MBA. But when I went back and I suffered through those statistic classes and I graduated, I have never felt so good about myself.
And you know what's funny? In Pro Coach, we call that impress yourself.
Impress yourself. That's really good.
Yeah. And that's the way to increase confidence. Actually, the formula we talk about for how to increase your confidence, because confidence, as you said, belief in yourself is totally crucial. And it's every time you impress yourself. So when you come up against that fear, if you move ahead into it and through it, then you build your confidence. And if you back down from it, you feel smaller.
Well, you know, it's like if anyone ever has been to the gym, and I'm a weightlifter, and the way you build muscles is by getting past your stop points. Like you lift until you can't lift anymore, and that's when you keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how you build muscle.
It's new muscle at that point. It's something you haven't done before, and you're going to a new place.
Yeah, wonderful way to put it.
So, of course, most people don't realize this, but the whole reason I conduct these interviews and the way I select my authors is really just because I want to talk to them about my own situation and learn from them. So one of the things I notice, and I'm sure many of my listeners have got the same situation, one of my challenges is I really want everybody to like me and to approve of me. And needless to say, that's quite contrary to standing up for myself and taking risks. Is that an issue you found as well with the women you work with?
It's a huge issue for women. Huge issue. And I congratulate you for being so authentic and speaking your truth like that.
Well, I want to learn. I want to get past this stuff, too. I deserve seven figures. Intellectually, I know that. But as you said, to the bottom of my toes, I don't. So there you go.
Here's what I found from the seven-figure women and eight and nine-figure. What they told me, and this was really also eye-opening for me, is what I heard from them is that it's important to put that, you know, to really, you have to make tough decisions. You have to make very tough decisions that often upset people within your organization and without. You have to make requests that upset people. But what their frame of mind was, I'd rather be respected than liked. What they had, they all had their community, their inner circle, call it what you may, of family, friends, and colleagues that they could count on for support and love and nurturing.
No matter what they did.
No matter. It's like your pro coach group. It says there's a place you can go to get the support you need.
Yes.
But in the business world, it's not about being loved. It's about being respected. It's not about winning a popularity contest. It's about going for profits.
We're getting the job done.
Getting the job done, which doesn't mean you have to be ugly about it. But it does mean you have to be uncomfortable and allow other people to be uncomfortable, too. So that mantra, I'd rather be respected than liked, it plays in my head all the time.
I like that. Put it on my screensaver.
And you have your wonderful group of pro coaches that are there to, when you fall down, they're there to help you pick you back up. Every single one of these seven-figure women were in some kind of support group. Every one, some kind of peer group, whether it was informal or formal, like the women's, the WPO, Women's President Organization, that was a big one. And I think the average earnings of the WPO was $11 million per person. But here's the thing. There they could let down. There they could ask for support, which helped them be very, tough skin is not something most women and many men were born with, but it's something we need to develop in order to go forth and flourish.
And when we have a group of others who believe in us and who are supporting us to go forth, you know, we know that that's where it matters.
It's critical. It's absolutely critical. What I found, this is the second thing I found that was so important when I went through my interviews with people who'd been through my workshops, is that one of the things, they had to click, but the second thing that was equally important as feeling their value was who they hung around with. That there were women who had made extraordinary, there was one woman in particular, she and her husband, and she had her husband go through the workbook too, she and her husband made extraordinary progress. She got totally out of debt. She wrote a book. They moved. How they just did so many, they achieved so many goals, but she couldn't up her income. And I said, well, tell me something. What are the people like? What are your friends like? How would they feel if you started making more money? And she said, oh, they freak out. And that's when I realized support is important. But it's not just support from mentors. It's support and your bosses. It's support from everybody you hang around because you become who you're with. If people are going to freak out or dislike you because you start making more money, then that's enough reason to hold you back for many people. Especially women who are so relationship-oriented. So it's really critical that you start hanging around with people who you want to be like, who are playing in the field you want to play in.
Well, it's funny you say that because what I noticed with many of the people that I've coached is that they're hanging around with people that, by all appearances, initially they want the person to win. But actually, at some level, they want them to win, but in a way that also works for them. So if the person was to make a lot more money, then it wouldn't work for them because then they wouldn't have, you know, the person might get superior or whatever. So it just feels like you've got to ask yourself, are the people I'm hanging out with not just friends, not just want me to win, but do they want me to win their way? Or are they okay with me winning in a win that's for me?
But here's the thing. In every system, and that can include friendship circles, families, colleagues, whatever circles you're in every system, when one part of that system changes, every part is affected. So when you go to make money, more money, you are in these people's face, and your change is forcing them to look at their own requirements and their own necessary need to change. And those people who try to hold you back, those negative, those pessimists, those worry warts, those naysayers, they're not bad people. They're just scared.
Right.
And they're saying, I don't have the courage to do what you're doing.
And I don't want to change. And we're going back now to your psychology background, short through here, and family systems theory, and how, you know, what I was taught when I studied psychology is that any environment, any community is like a mobile. They're hanging from the ceiling with all the, you know, different branches hanging down,
yeah.
Right? And then if one piece of the mobile changes, if one piece hanging down moves to a different place, every other part of the mobile has to shift itself to come back into balance. But rather than that, they would rather stay where they are and put all of the pressure on the piece that moved to go back.
Which is why I had an exercise in overcoming under-earning.
Oh, you've got great exercises.
I've got great exercises. And one of them is a chart with four kinds of supports that you need to be looking out for. And the fifth column is naysayers. And I have people really fill this out. And I have them look at the naysayers in their life. And while you're going in that process of going from under-earning to higher-earning, to higher-earning to even higher-earning, while you're in that discomfort zone, it's really critical that you minimize or eliminate the time that you spend with naysayers, even if they're in your own family.
Mm-hmm.
Because during that time in the discomfort zone, it's a very fragile time, and it's very easy to be knocked back.
You're looking for an easy out, and if they give you a good rational reason why you shouldn't do it, it's hard to fight back.
But it's not even an easy out. It's not even, yes, if you're looking for an easy out, that makes it easy. But even if you're trying really hard to succeed, and you have people like kids hanging on your leg, trying to pull you back, just emotionally, psychologically, that is a really tough place to be.
So you have five steps in the book in terms of moving from being an under-earner to really getting your worth. And I'd like to talk to you about just a couple of them. I mean, people who want to get them all can read the book. But your second step, which is make a decision. You say something interesting. You say a decision is not the same as a wish, a dream, or even a goal. So talk about that.
Yeah. A goal is a destination you want to get to. A decision implies that you have the commitment and the determination to do it. Because the real decision is you have to figure out which game you're playing. There's two games in the world of money, in the world of earnings. There's the under-earning game and the higher-earning game. And the under-earning game is called not to lose. And the way you play not to lose is you stay safe, you stay comfortable, you look good, and you want to make sure you don't lose. In the high-earning game, you go as far as you can with all that you got. And when you fall down, as you always do, you get back up and you keep going.
And this is a game like people like Donald Trump, who I don't even know how many times he's been bankrupt, or with, you know, all of these people that are high income earners have been bankrupted. Or most of them, at some point along the way, they're really aggressive entrepreneurs. They go bankrupt and they get up and they make even more.
Oh, I see what you're saying. And it's not even, yeah, it's like whatever stumbling block is in your way, whatever trips you up, and you will be tripped up, is you get back up and you just keep going, whether it's bankruptcy or just burnout. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's just people angry with you or your own fear. You just get back up, keep going. People talk about bad luck and bad luck and bad luck and bad luck. And when you let bad luck trip you up, you're becoming a victim to circumstances. And the more powerful and financially successful the people like that are, they're so out of victimhood, and they're so into, I create this. Whatever comes at me is an opportunity to do it differently.
Uh-huh. So, well, it's funny because you talk about, you know, the resolve to keep going and so on, and yet there's also one of the things I notice about people that I would call workaholics, and I can be categorized that way as well. I work much, much harder than I probably ideally should. And, you know, I'm putting in the effort, but my suspicion is that I'm not confronting the limitations and stretching myself, getting out of my comfort zone enough to do what I know I need to do. So there actually can be a comfort zone in being on the treadmill and working really hard as well, can't there?
Oh, that's such a good point. That is such a good point. Because what I found among women who make six figures, seven figures, eight figures, nine, is that the ones who lead the most balanced life, and yes, you can lead the most balanced life and still make big money, but it's that they learned they actually work fewer hours and made more money. This was a shock to me.
Mm.
You can work fewer hours. It's your focus. Often what we do is we get into this busyness mode, working hard mode, in order to make us feel that we're doing something. We're doing enough. We get into this struggle. It justifies our existence. It makes us feel like we have value. Also, workaholism. Workaholism is an addiction. And I'm not suggesting you have the addiction, but there's a difference between addiction and desire. Desire comes from owning your value and feeding your vision. Addiction comes from an I'm not enough feeling.
And it's feeding a dysfunction.
It's a fear, yeah. It's a fear. And I know when I go into my overeating, when I go into that overworking, which I can go into, I know it's because I'm trying to repress something that's trying to come up.
So we're not confronting. We're basically avoiding the invitation of fear to move forward. Instead, we're turning it down. We're closing the door on it.
The first step, which you passed over, but I think is the most important step, and it's really very rarely talked about, it's telling the truth. It's telling the truth about what's not working. It's telling the truth about what's not working without blame or judgment or shame. It's telling the truth about what's not working without blame or judgment and without even having a solution. It's a willingness to say, this isn't working. And it could be and a problem, any problem you have, it could be as simple as, this feeling that something's not right, to, oh, my God, I can't pay the rent yet again. Because what I learned from every single successful person I've interviewed is financial achievement is always preceded by a financial challenge. And when people say to me, I don't know where to start. I don't know where to start overcoming under. I don't know where to start to go to the next level. I say, start with what's not working. Start by facing a problem. Even if you don't have a solution, it's telling the truth. And, of course, not all problems are on the outside. It's also what is not working in terms of your attitudes, beliefs, and decisions that you've made about yourself and money. Just telling the truth, 9 times out of 10, gives you the clarity to take the right next step.
Makes a lot of sense. So the first one, we are doing steps. The first step is tell the truth. And really, you've got some great exercises in the book for that and getting the clarity around what's going on. And then,
and even you're saying, I'm working too hard, is a brilliant example of telling the truth.
If I take the time and to actually realize it's my truth and don't just say it, toss it off, and ignore it.
Right. Because problems have a purpose. They're there to get our attention. And as Henry Kissinger said, a problem ignored is a crisis invited. So the time to address those problems is early on. And once you tell the truth, it's like the universe will show you what you need to do.
Hmm. So step one, tell the truth. Step two, make a decision.
Decisions, once you make a decision to profit, we can do a little exercise right here, okay? You want to do exercise?
Absolutely.
Okay, I want everybody listening to write down on a piece of paper how much they'd like to make in this next year. They could do it this year or for a year from now.
Okay.
How much you want to make based on what you feel you're worth, not what the market will bear. That's important. So write that down. And I want to tell you, if that's a committed decision, this is what I'm going to make, not a desire, not a wish, but a committed decision, this is what I'm going to make, two things will happen. One, you will start attracting coincidences. And you know how that works, Andrew. You know how that works.
Absolutely.
All of a sudden, you know you're going to be sitting on a plane and there's somebody who has just the person you need to talk to. And coincidences. It's like, it's almost cosmic, but a decision is like a magnet. It will draw opportunities to you. The second thing that will happen is you don't want to do them. You don't want to take advantage of those opportunities. Always lie just outside your comfort zone.
Going to get uncomfortable, that's right.
So that's why the third step is so important. You have to be willing to stretch. Every single woman I interviewed, and man, came to a point where they said, oh no, I can't do that. No way, no how. And they did it anyway. And they didn't always succeed, as we spoke about, but they always got back up and kept going. And that stretch is a pivotal point that divides under-earners from higher-earners. And you know when it's time to stretch, when you hear yourself saying, I can't do that. Oh, no way, no how. That's the very thing you need to do next. And the fourth step, because it's not easy to stretch, is where Pro Coach comes in. You have to surround yourself with support. This is critical. We've talked about it. But joining organizations like Pro Coach, getting just really marinating in, surrounding yourself with support is key to keep going. And the fifth step comes from the fact that I was shocked how many high earners are not wealthy.
Okay, before we go to step five, I want to quickly go back to step four, the create community. And I mean, I understand exactly what you're saying. And it's not just being around like-minded people that support you, but also there's inspiration. I mean, just to see other people can do it, and that they're getting it, and you're one of them. You see yourself as a peer with them. There's so much that comes from that. But you said, there's a great quote in the book. You said, no one will do this for me, but I don't have to do it alone. That's just so powerful.
It is powerful. It was powerful for me, because that's one of the things I learned when I interviewed women for Prince Charming Isn't Coming, that in order to be smart about money, you have to really get that no one's doing this for me. And at the same time, I don't have to do it alone.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, now that's step number five, respect and appreciate money. So you were talking,
right. Because money wealth does not come from what you earn. It comes from what you do with what you earn. And the people with the highest net worth that I've interviewed for all my books are not necessarily the people who make the most money or marry the most money or inherit the most money, but they are the ones who take care of their money. And almost all of them, I would say virtually all of them at some point, have worked with financial professionals, often a team of them. Because the key to creating wealth, to becoming a wealth builder, as apart from just a consumer, a wealth builder, there's 4 rules of money to follow. And those 4 rules are you spend less, you save more, you invest wisely, and you give generously in that order. Because most of us have a giving generously part on that. But with giving generously without spending less, saving more, investing wisely is an act of self-sabotage.
Right.
Because not only do you jeopardize your own future security, but you diminish the impact that you can make in giving your money away.
Interesting. So, you know, one of the things everybody in my audience is entrepreneurial, self-employed, or investor of some sort. The one thing everyone wants is freedom. And what I've discovered myself personally is that debt is slavery. The minute you have any kind of debt you have to pay on a consistent basis, I mean, it really is the definition of slavery. You are indebted to somebody else, and it totally takes away your freedom.
Exactly. Let me put this way. There's good debt and there's bad debt. When you are low in debt, like for a mortgage on a house, that's good debt because theoretically it's growing. It's also deductible. At least in America it is. I'm in Canada.
Well, it's actually not in Canada, but still, it's okay. You know, theoretically it's going to appreciate and it provides a home. So we won't get into the Robert Kiyosaki, whether your home is an investment or expense, but there is good debt and bad debt.
But here's the thing what I found in interviewing successful people. Not one of them really stepped fully into success until they stopped debting. They didn't even have to have it all paid off, but they had to have a plan in place for paying it off.
Mm-hmm.
Because exactly what you said, Andrew, debt sucks your energy. It sucks your creativity. It actually sucks the life out of you. So debt is dangerous. Debt is slavery. You are so right.
Well, you know, there is a fine line, though, between good dad and bad dad. I mean, I remember there was a time when I went through my transition and started becoming a coach in the early 90s, and I was out of work. That's how I kind of came to this point of, well, what am I going to do that makes a difference, and how am I going to contribute? I ended up starting my own business, and I actually lived off my savings for almost 2 years. And I remember my financial planner saying, Andrew, you're a spender. You're a spender. You've got to stop spending. And I was really clear that I was investing. And I was investing in myself by taking the courses I was taking, and I was not spending. I was not taking vacations. I was not buying the toys, the doodads, as Kiyosaki would call them. But so there, you know, I was going into debt, and I know people take courses and they go into debt. So where's the line on that? Any thoughts?
Here's the important thing. You have to spend less than you earn. You have to save enough in case of emergency. And you have to invest wisely, which means you diversify. All your investing isn't in one place. And your investment needs to be time to grow. So when you are putting all your money in your business, all of it, without saving, and going into debt is a very, very dangerous place to be.
Mm-hmm.
It worked for you, apparently.
Well, I didn't go into debt. I was using savings I already had as well.
Yeah.
So.
But what would scare me about that, if you were putting all your money in your business and you weren't replenishing the savings, that what kicks people into debt is when a medical or some kind of emergency arises.
Yes.
And they don't have sufficient savings. So it's just, I believe in diversification. I believe having some of your money in cash, some of your money in your own business, some of your money in stocks, and some of your money in bonds. And money you need in the next 5 years, you need to put that in cash. Money you need in 5 to 10 years should be in stocks and bonds. Money you won't need for 10 years can be in real estate and stocks exclusively.
So
you'll see in this economy, the people who were hurt most were people who did not have enough cash.
Right. That's true. Yeah, because if you didn't need the money for 5 or 10 years, your investment, your net worth is down, but it's not going to hurt you on a day-to-day basis.
Right. So when he said to you, you're spending, and you saw it as investing, yes, you were investing, but it was very undiversified.
Yes.
And I think that was his concern, which was justified.
By the way, just for your information, it was a woman who was my financial advisor and a very, very good financial advisor and a seven-figure earner. So there you go. Now, what about tracking spending? Does that fit into the whole thing you talk about, number one, tell the truth, and then B, respect and appreciate money? Do we need to know exactly what our net worth is and how much we're spending
and
so on?
Yes, because this goes back to telling the truth. Clarity is power. There's no two ways about it. And I always encourage everybody, even if they're not in debt, and I never had a problem with debt other than my $1 million to the IRS, but I never had a problem with credit card debt, yet I spent years tracking my spending just to be clear where I was spending. I know exactly my net worth. I know exactly where it is. If you don't know, I recommend everybody, every single person, if they haven't already, sit down with a fee-only financial planner. Look at everything they have, everything in their life, from their insurance to their earnings to their outgo. And a fee-only financial planner will sit down, will do a plan, will based on what you have now, where you want to go, and how you will get there. That is the most calming thing you can do, especially during uncertain times.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an international network of fee-only financial planners that I highly recommend. I'm not one of them. I'm not a financial professional. But it's Garrett, G-A-R-R-E-T-T, Garrett Financial Network.
Excellent. Thank you. So we're getting towards the end here, but I wanted to actually go back to the very first page of your book. And you said the first words is, there is no someday. So one of the things I noticed is people, I'm now 56 years old. It's just, I guess I had an experience we all had at some point, but I had my first peer who has died of natural causes recently. And I'm going, oh, my heavens, time is running out. And yet so many people I hear, they see not taking action. They're just delaying and saying, I'm going to get to it, but they're not making what you call the decision. So how do we deal with that?
With inertia?
Well, just that I'm thinking, well, I'll get to it tomorrow, or we're not taking action, even though we know we need to, even though we know the things we want are...
Oh, my gosh, we all do that. We all do that. But here's the thing. Just know this, that if you don't take action, the world will take action. The universe will take action on you. So when I get in that place of inertia, when I get in that place, I know I need to take action. What I do is I get either go to a class, join a group like ProCoach, or get a good friend to kick me in the butt and hold me accountable. And I would say that's where your group would be of real service, is holding your members accountable.
Oh, there's no question. But what I notice is a lot of people don't join our group for exactly that reason, because they know that if they make a commitment and join a coaching program, they are going to be held accountable. And as you mentioned, that's uncomfortable.
Oh, that's why I work with a coach. I have my own coach I work with. And it's for that simple reason that an object, what do they say? It's a law of physics, that an object that's not in motion will stay not in motion.
That's right.
So after upon my third object, if someone doesn't want to move, when I coach people, if they don't want to, if they're not willing to do the work, I can't force them. And I remember I had a coach, my mentor, Karen McCall, who is a pioneer in financial recovery. She said to me, I will work as hard as I can for you, but I will never work harder than you.
Absolutely. And, you know, I must say that there's people I see that come to me and they want to get some results, but they do expect me to work harder than them, or they want to blame me when they're not getting the results. And, I mean, ultimately, as you said before, you know, no one will do this for me. You don't have to do it alone, and a coach is part of doing it, not on your own, but you can go
and
work.
And not everybody's ready. You know, if people are having relationship problems, if they're having health problems, if they're having really deep financial problems, and their survival and security and relationships are in jeopardy, they really don't have the energy. They have to get those primary needs met before they're ready to talk about overcoming hunger.
Yes. Well, I'm just thinking about the discomfort part, and you and your coach. I have to say probably the most uncomfortable time I spend every month is with my coach. And, you know, I mean, I have a high-voltage coach who really, you know, tests me every single month, and I always have to confront those things that are my unconfrontables and move ahead, because that's how I got to where I am. I mean, I started out, you know, could barely rub two sticks together. I was earning $20,000 or less a year as a coach when I started this journey, and it's only by confronting my fears. So this has been just fantastically helpful. And, Barbara, you know, your book, you know, it's so incredibly valuable. I just think everybody should read it. It goes far deeper than what we've talked about, and the exercises are fantastic. So they can get that on your website.
They can get all my books on my website.
Okay, which is www.barbarastanny.com.
Yes.
And tell us about other work. I know there's a quiz on your website that people can determine whether they're truly an under-earner. You've got a blog. You've got some teleseminars as well. Tell us about that.
Right now I'm just finishing up a teleseminar called Becoming Your Own Prince Charming, and that's about managing money. And I will be starting an Overcoming Under-Earning 5-session teleseminar. I'm doing a live seminar in New York City, and every month, and I'm having one tomorrow, every month I have a free Ask Barbara call where you can get on and ask me anything you want. I'm really committed. I am so committed to empowering women and their significant others around money. And that's what my life and that's what my work is all about. So I invite you to visit my website, barbarastanny.com. And I have to say, Andrew, I think you are a fabulous role model for people aspiring to more.
Well, you know, you and I do have the same purpose. I mean, you're empowering women around money. I'm empowering small business owners, self-employed entrepreneurs, to gain more confidence and as well as the financial security to confront their fears through their businesses. I mean, we do the same thing. And quite honestly, I love your work. And at some point, I actually am thinking I may want to get authorized to lead your workshops up here in Canada. I mean, the material is so powerful.
The material is very powerful. And I have coaches all over the United States and Canada, either leading my seminar. I have a seminar in the box, which everything is there, the licensed product, or I train coaches on how to do my teleseminars.
Fantastic.
So I want to get the word out, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to do that.
Well, I'm glad, and we need to wrap up now, but just on behalf of myself and all of our ProCoach audience, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. It's been fantastic.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
So that's it for this month. I trust you and the listeners found this useful, and please go to Barbara's website to find out more about her work. Just a reminder that we have my previous interviews also posted on the ProCoach website under the newsletter tab. And, of course, if you want to accelerate your business results and confront your fears and overcome your under-earning through your small business, I encourage you to contact us and find out about our coaching program, the ProCoach Success System. And that's it for now. This is Andrew Barbarastanny saying goodbye, and I look forward to bringing you another Mastermind interview presentation next month.